Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Chris Carr. Chris Carr is a multiple New York Times best-selling author, speaker, and world-renowned wellness advocate. She's the subject and director of the documentary Crazy Sexy Cancer, which aired on TLC, the Discovery Channel, and the Oprah Winfrey Network. Her latest books are Crazy Sexy Juice and Crazy Sexy Kitchen. Chris has been featured in many publications and TV shows, including Vanity Fair, Scientific American, Good Morning America, The Today Show, and The Doctors. She is on a mission to help as many people as possible to claim their health, to live with gusto, and to make every day count. So now, Chris, we love your work, and we're so grateful for this time. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Chris, for being with us again.
Thank you, John and Ocean. I'm excited to be here. I love you both so much.
Well, thank you. It's totally mutual, and I'm sure our listeners are going to love you too, those of them who haven't already had that pleasure of experiencing you. You've made such an extraordinary journey, Chris, and it began in a certain sense on Valentine's Day 14 or so years ago when you received a terrifying cancer diagnosis. You were told you had a stage 4 cancer in your liver and your lungs that was, they said, inoperable and incurable. What I want to ask you, Chris, to start our conversation is, what enabled you to understand and experience cancer not as the stereotypical death sentence, but as a chance to truly live your life?
Well, you know, I think like most people, cancer was my wake-up call. But because, as you said, my disease, you know, doesn't work like most cancers, and it's certainly taken me on a very deep personal journey. And because I live with cancer and I've been living with it for about 14 years now, my disease is super rare, and there's no cure and there's no treatment, but it is slow growing. And for right now, it's kind of just been hanging out, so to speak. Now, of course, like that could change at some point, and it could become aggressive in the future, which is why I get scanned and, you know, my doctors look under the hood every once in a while. But for now, we're living well together, and I always say that I'm really grateful for that. You know, if anything, cancer has taught me more about living than dying, as facing your mortality often does. And so I don't often use the word gift because it's not something I would give to somebody else. But there have been many blessings along the way. There's so many things that I was afraid to do before I had cancer. And now I say, what do I have to lose, you know? It's time to get busy living.
And you have. I mean, you after that diagnosis, you made a lot of changes. You embraced a really healthy lifestyle. You launched a career as a wellness activist. And the changes that you've made in your life have been inspiration to millions of people. You know, I'm thinking about the Serenity Prayer, in which we ask for the courage to change the things we can. We ask for the serenity to accept the things we can't change. And we ask for the wisdom to know the difference. You've clearly had the courage to make major changes in your life. But what I want to ask you, Chris, is what have you learned along the way about self-acceptance?
Well, in the beginning of my disease, I wanted it to go away, like so many other patients. And I couldn't have chemo, I couldn't have radiation, I couldn't have surgery. And I didn't know anything else before diving into this world of holistic living. I thought you got your diagnosis and then you went to the hospital and they tried to deal with it. But in not being able to, like, quote unquote, deal with it and make something about myself go away that I didn't like, I had to turn to acceptance. I live with cancer. I may live with cancer for the rest of my life. Cancer may kill me someday, but that is not today. And I can't feel like a failure. I can't feel like I'm broken. I can't not take care of myself and give up. And I think sometimes when people think about acceptance, they think about a white flag, like it is giving up or lowering your standards. And that's quite the contrary. You know, it's about respecting yourself, and it's about owning your self-worth. And I think from that place, when we truly acknowledge our worth, we start to take better care of ourselves. We make decisions from a place of strength and resilience and from understanding that we matter and our choices matter. And that is the power of radical acceptance. You know, we're not broken. We're not messes. We don't need fixing. We need loving so that we can take care of ourselves and take care of this beautiful planet that we live on.
And those are beautiful thoughts. We're not broken. But we live in a Judeo-Christian cultural context that historically teaches us to, I mean, it has a stunning ability to produce feelings of guilt.
Yeah.
and many of us have been taught to see God as a punishing parent. It's easy for us to see illness as a punishment.
Right.
Chris, what's the difference between feeling guilty for being ill, as a lot of us will tend to do, and on the other hand, taking responsibility for your life?
Well, you just made me think of something. I'm going to answer your question, but I have this picture of myself on my bulletin board above my desk, and I'm 5 years old, and I'm at Playland in Rye, New York, and it's my birthday, and I'm smiling so big and so bright, and my teeth are a disaster, John. Let me tell you, braces were definitely in the future. But the light from this being is so, so bright. And when I think about punishment, I think, would you punish your kid? Would you punish the little you for getting sick? Would you turn to a child and say, you're bad because you're sick? No, you wouldn't. You'd do everything in your power to help that child get well. And so the past is over. It's done. It's finito. It's over. But we can learn from it, right? There's certain things that we can definitely learn from it as we become what I like to call empowered participants in our well-being. Everybody listening to this interview is an empowered participant because you guys all showed up. I often say that I wish we were born with owner's manuals, but we're not. So it's our job to learn how our bodies work and how to take care of them. And, you know, what we put in them matters. And you learn all about this through John and Ocean's work. What we put on them matters. And, of course, those things affect our health. Not to punish ourselves or feel guilty, but to make better choices in the future. Because we are resilient. And sometimes we can even reverse the pickles we get ourselves into as long as we understand what we need to do to care for ourselves.
Well, when you say it's our job to learn how to take care of ourselves, I'm remembering that Dr. Kelly Turner.
Yeah, I love her.
She's researched, she's studied, she's analyzed thousands of cases of the radical remission of cancer. And these are people who cured their cancer either in the absence of conventional medicine entirely or after conventional medicine had failed them. And she says that the majority of the people she studied, and she has studied thousands, all tend to make the same four dietary changes. They greatly reduce or eliminate sugar, meat, dairy, and refined foods. They greatly increase fruit and vegetable intake. They eat organic foods, and they drink filtered water. Chris, it seems to me that these dietary shifts, these kinds of shifts, would be good for all of us, whether or not we have cancer, and they are part of learning to take good care of ourselves. Would you tend to agree? What's your perspective on those dietary shifts?
Absolutely. I think Kelly's work is wonderful and so powerful and fabulous and spot on. You know, our bodies are designed to function with ease, but they do require good fuel and basic maintenance. Not a lot, but some basic maintenance. So what Kelly suggests is right on, as I said. And it goes a long way towards nourishing our bodies at the cellular level. So I believe that what she describes is an anti-inflammatory approach to disease management and also to healthy living, as you said. So it works for both sets. Now, we know that the root cause of most diseases is inflammation. So inflammation comes from stress, from our food, from our lifestyle. So what we want to do is try to reduce that inflammation. And also what she talks about is, you know, filling our plates and our glasses with nutrient-dense foods and choices. So it's good nutrition, good fuel, real fuel, as opposed to fake foods and empty calories and so on. Now, what she also suggests improves our not only our overall health and our immunity, but also our gut health. And we know that our gut is kind of like the root of our immune system. So it's very important that we take care of it. I often reflect on the power of plants. And the truth is that most prescriptions, most Western medicine prescriptions, come from the plant kingdom in some way. And there's a reason for that. It's because plants are our medicine, as you know, John. They're filled with phytochemicals, which are the cancer fighters, vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, enzymes, and the list goes on. So it makes a lot of sense from my perspective as a patient, but also as a wellness teacher and advocate, that plants should be the star of our plates, the star of our glasses, rather than just the obligatory side dish that we've sometimes become accustomed to. I could go on and on about this. I mean, I'll say a couple more things. So what I like to teach is what I call the five pillars of prevention. And they come from what we're eating, what we're drinking, what we're thinking, and how we're resting and how we're renewing. For me, resting is, you know, are we getting enough sleep? And renewing is, are we playing? Do we have free time? Are we getting up from our desks? Are we enjoying our lives? Are we making it matter and count? So when those pillars are strong, so are we. But when one or more of them topple, I think that's when we get into trouble. So going back to the top of your question, Kelly is spot on. And the more we, not only as patients, take that advice, but people who are interested in not becoming patients, those are the ones who should really take her advice.
You know, I see you, Chris, as one of the pillars of the Plant Strong movement. And I remember you signing some of your emails a while back, Peace and Veggies. So to you, I gather, a plant-strong, plant-passionate, plant-based diet is really important. It's a really critical pillar of optimal health.
Yes, that is the medicine. That is what I believe in. That is what I teach. That is what I practice myself. And that is what I truly love.
You know, I know you're a fan of making and drinking fresh veggie juices.
Yes.
So two questions here. First, what is it about juices that you love? And secondly, are there tips you might give to our listeners who want to, as I've heard you say, make juice not war?
So when I first got into this, it was obviously through cancer. And I went and got a book at Whole Foods, believe it or not, and I just started to teach myself how to cook plant-based foods. A few years into it, I discovered juicing. I was at a place in Florida. And I saw so many very, very sick patients, much sicker than me, though I do have an advanced cancer. And the cornerstone of what they were teaching at this health institute was juicing. Now, not juicing like you see in popular stores or, you know, juices that you can buy in those popular stores, which are very high in sugar. These are medicinal juices that were very low glycemic and pretty much green. And it's kind of like the basis of what I make every single day, but it's cucumber and celery and kale or any leafy green that you have, maybe a little lemon and some apple. Very simple. Folks were drinking these juices multiple times a day, and they also went 100% plant-based. Now, what I saw there blew my mind. I saw people who were unable to stand or walk or get out of bed literally within weeks of this program, and in addition to lots of detoxification and other things that were taking place, come back to life. And so when I left there, I thought, I'm going to make juicing a very important part of my teaching, but also my personal healing diet. And again, it's low glycemic. I make juice every single day. I make a big one in the morning. I make it for my husband, and we have several servings throughout the day. And it really helped me move from having that like energy dip and that coffee break and getting on that roller coaster to having sustainable energy and really feeling much better, improving my overall immunity and so on. And it's not just about juicing. You can make healthy smoothies, which I love to make as well. The point is to make sure that they're green, keep them low glycemic and nutrient dense, and to actually use those blenders and juicers that many folks have, but they use as dust collectors instead. Very popular dust collectors, and I just suggest that we dust them off and start using them again.
You know, you mentioned getting a book at Whole Foods.
Your book was one of them, I must say.
That's great. I remember you saying another time that when you started your journey, mainly through medical desperation, you went racing around Whole Foods. You were filling your shopping cart with kale because it was dark green and it had to be good for you. But in the back of your mind, you were wondering what you were ever going to do with this weed. And you really weren't familiar with it then. So Chris, that's the case for a lot of folks. How did you learn to like foods like kale that are highly nutritious, that are wonderful for us, but which can be unfamiliar and even scary to people at first?
That's a great question. You know, for all the people out there who grew up on the standard American diet, I used to love Burger King. I wasn't a McDonald's girl. I was a Burger King girl. And I remember when the first Burger King opened up where I lived, I was 9 years old and I literally walked 10 miles. I went through my mom's purse, got all of her change, walked to Burger King, ordered a small fry, enjoyed myself, and then saved like a dime, because back then a phone call was a dime, to call my grandmother, who was flipping out wondering where the hell I was. I was like, I'm done with my Burger King. Please come get me. So when I saw kale, I got to tell you, I was terrified. And I was also really depressed. I thought, is this the life I'm going to have to live if I'm going to want to, you know, try to help myself and not die of cancer? And there was some depression. There was definitely some like making peace with what is. But that was before I knew how good it could be and how good I could feel. All it took me was some experimenting and that willingness to get in my kitchen, read some recipes, and I took some cooking classes. I went to various health institutes, and I just started to teach myself. And I made many mistakes along the way, many mistakes, and either fed them to my husband or my dog. But I also made some gems and two New York Times bestsellers. So I think the point is that we have to be willing to try new things, to experiment, to if we feel overwhelmed, to deal with that overwhelm, you know, scream it out, tap it out, dance it out, whatever you got to do. But get yourself back in that kitchen, because the kitchen is the heart of the home. And it's also the place where we heal. That's where the medicine is. And to be resistant to it or to outsource our food to fast food chains or restaurants or takeout services, we're really missing the mark. We can't get optimal health by outsourcing our well-being. It's not possible.
It's an inside job. It's something we need to do for ourselves. When you talk about how we really need to be able to or willing to try new things, I'm thinking about how many of us find feelings of safety and security in our habitual routines. And a lot of us derive comfort from the foods we grew up eating and the foods we're used to eating. I sometimes feel like healthy diet should come with a warning label, warning people that if you eat healthfully, you're going to feel more alive. You're going to feel things you maybe have buried or distanced from. It can be destabilizing. It can be confusing at first. Chris, what do you say to people who find the prospects of taking such a journey to be overwhelming?
I started so quickly because I was scared. But I think that people often do better when they go slow and steady. It's kind of like adopting turtle power. Slow and steady wins the race. So if it seems too overwhelming at first, just try one thing. You know, sometimes it's not about what you remove from your plate right away, right? It's about what you add. So if we start to add a green juice or maybe a vegetable dish, or maybe a meatless Monday, or we decide that instead of a burger, we'll try a veggie burger, or, you know, instead of that like processed dessert, we'll have a bowl of blueberries and like revive our palate. And we start to clean up our palate. We are blown away by the fact that we don't need so much fat and salt and sugar. We can get the most satisfaction from the simplest, freshest foods. So slowly adding these new things, one thing at a time, and see how they feel. And when you get more ambitious and more adventurous, you can add some more. And what will happen is you will start to edge out the things that don't serve you. There's only so much room in our bellies and our lives for BS, John. So the BS starts to go as the healthy foods and healthy lifestyle practices start to take over.
When we first start a new way of eating, we might be afraid that it will be hard to live in the world and participate in social situations the way we have been doing. And we worry that it will make our relationships more difficult. And what we don't know what we'll say in certain situations. Chris, can you relate to those kinds of concerns?
Absolutely. You know, oh my goodness. I made a lot of mistakes along the way in the early days. First of all, I was very passionate about plant-based living and veganism. And I remember one Thanksgiving where I stood on my soapbox in the middle of the dining room table and I told my family why turkey was, you know, bad and shouldn't be on the plate and la, la, la. And let me tell you what, I ruined Thanksgiving. So I learned a lot from that experience, but I also learned a lot from being out in the world and meeting thousands and thousands of people every year. And we all need to come to this when we're ready and come to it in our own way. But obviously, we need to come to it. And when it comes to social situations, you know, certain people may not be up for the journey. And sometimes our success can inflame them. It can almost be an example of why they're not doing well in their own lives. So I think it's important for us to be compassionate, to not take things personally, to be the light, to be the change, but not bop people over the head. And I will say, and this is not because this is going to happen for everybody or other people, but certain relationships that I was in were very unhealthy. And so they kind of faded away as my life improved and my health improved and my overall energy and the energy I decided to surround myself with improved, right? I like upscaled everything because I believe that that's what my body deserved and that's what my spirit deserved as well. It doesn't make it easy, but you learn a lot from the journey. And I'd also say that the people in my life now, who I love, you and Ocean being two of them, I love bringing folks along for the ride, you know, introducing them to new things as opposed to being terrified that they're going to reject me. So it changes, but we can change it in an empowering way versus a isolating way.
Well, an empowering way versus an isolating way. I'm thinking of a friend of mine who is dealing with a very serious medical problem and is making a sincere effort to eat healthier foods and actually feels that her life depends on doing so. She lives with people who aren't sympathetic. One of her housemates keeps chiding her for not eating cakes that the housemate makes, telling her she shouldn't be so uptight, she should live a little. And recently, this housemate brought my friend a piece of cake, which my friend did not want to eat, but she succumbed to her housemate's pressure, and she ate it. And then her housemate smiled and patted her on the back and said, good girl, good girl. And I don't know if you have ever dealt with this kind of a situation. Do you have any counsel for people who deal with this kind of thing?
You know, when we're busy lowering our standards for other people, we certainly aren't raising them for ourselves. And so I think that this is an example of well-meaning people whose buttons are being pushed. They can't see that she needs to do this for herself. What they're seeing is their own failure at times. You know, I don't get that as much anymore, but I certainly did in the beginning. But I get things in other ways. Let's say, for example, I might get a comment on my blog where somebody wants me to incite me or provoke me or challenge me or push me in a direction where I don't want to go. It happens every once in a while. And what I do is I make a strong boundary around it. And so sometimes we need to make very strong boundaries with people. And I would say that those housemates are examples of people we need to make strong boundaries around. I'm doing this for my health. I don't appreciate you undermining my efforts. It doesn't feel good to me. It doesn't feel like you're supporting me. My life depends on this. And if you want to be in my life, you need to be on board because this is not helpful. And maybe those housemates aren't the right housemates for her.
Those are tough questions to ask or tough boundaries to make in some situations. You strike me as someone who doesn't wait around for anyone to give you permission to choose what would truly serve your highest good. But a lot of us are waiting around for somebody to give us permission, permission to live. And usually we don't get it. It has to be something that comes from within us. We have to give that permission to ourselves first and foremost. But Chris, when we have somebody who reflects that to us, someone who reflects our possibilities and our greater potential back to us, as you do for so many people, I think it becomes more possible for many of us to start to live by our own higher wisdom and to start to take the actions by which we will most fully thrive. And I think one of your great contributions, Chris, is that by your example and through your message and your wisdom, you're giving people what they need to give themselves permission to live.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for that. You know, I agree with, well, no, you're absolutely right. People aren't going to give us permission, but that permission is our birthright. And it took me a long time to understand that. I was very shy and I was very introverted. And I waited for permission till I was 31 years old and it didn't come. And then cancer came. And that wake up call was what gave me the permission. I said, nobody's going to live this life but me. I don't know how long I have, but I'm not going to wait around. As I said earlier, I'm going to start get busy living and taking care of myself. And I started to think about what my purpose was, what our purpose is. It's not about the job. It's not about the mission. It's not about the calling. It's not about doing great in the world, though that is very important and noble. It's not about your stature. Our purpose, I believe, is to love ourselves, to respect ourselves, to get to know ourselves at the deepest possible level. That is what we have this great opportunity to do while we're in this body, in this vessel, in this time in our life. And I believe that from that place, we start to polish our energy. We start to shine. We stop holding back. We're less worried about what others think of ourselves and more worried about what we think of ourselves. And from that place, it creates a ripple effect. When you're kind to yourself and love yourself and treasure yourself for the treasure that you are, it's very easy to do the same for other people. And I think that now more than ever, we need to do that for other people. We need to do it for ourselves. I always come back to the animals and the planet. It's very crucial. And so that permission is just like a call to action. It's not like I don't know. It's not something you wait around for. It's something that you are destined for.
Yeah, no, I remember it kind of grabbing me that if I didn't give myself permission to fully live, to fully be who I am, and to honor my unique nature and what uniquely serves me and helps me feel best and function best, that I was selling myself short, selling life short, and really defaulting on my destiny in some way. And I remember when I changed my diet and I stopped eating junk food and I stopped eating ice cream and I began eating as healthfully as I could, a lot happened. And not only did I feel a whole lot better, but my mind was clearer and I felt more aligned with my highest purposes. Chris, do you see a relationship between the food we eat and our capacity to live according to our highest vision for ourselves?
Absolutely. And look at the shifts that happened in your life, the shifts that happened in your family. And you really are the godfather. I mean, you are a source of such great inspiration to me and everybody in this healthy living movement. And I'm so grateful for the risks that you took and the challenges that you had to overcome and the light that you stepped into, because if you hadn't have stepped into that light, I wouldn't have had one of my first books to say, you see, this makes sense.
Thank you.
Not only to myself, but to the people around me who are like, are you crazy? You can't just sustain yourself on plants. Where are you going to get your protein? La, la, la. So I just want to honor you. Every time I talk about you, I talk about you with such respect and reverence, because I don't know that I could be me without you being you in the world.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris. I take that in, and I appreciate that. It helps me live, you know, that much more deeply true to my highest understandings of what life wants from me. And you know, we are examples for one another. We do reflect each other's magnificence or not. And I want to ask you, because I know you work a lot with women, empowering women to step into more vibrant lives. What are some of the most common places in your experience, Chris, where women in particular tend to get stuck?
I think we're really hard on ourselves, John. I think we're really, really tough on ourselves, more so maybe than men are. I'm not sure about that, but it's something I suspect. I think that women focus on perfection. And if we don't do it right, why bother? You know, we failed, we might as well throw in the towel and you know, eat, drink, and do whatever else that we want to do because we're bad in some way, we're flawed in some way, we can't do it in some way, you know, we don't have the goods in some way. And that's a bunch of nonsense. Perfectionism is the death of progress. And so I believe in progress, not perfection. That is my mantra, progress, not perfection. I am not cured from cancer, right? But I'm making progress, John. <You know? laughs> Right? Perfection is like, you're cured. Oh, there's a pink ribbon around your fairy tale story. No, that's not the way it is. So if more women could just focus on that progress and not perfection, I think we'd do better. And I also think that we need more support. So oftentimes in the home, the role of the woman is that of nurturer, that of caregiver, that of food provider. And what I have seen many women, certainly through the programs and the books that I have put out in the world do, is they'll make their own food and then make another meal for their family. And that can be really, really tough on women, especially women who work long hours, have a lot of responsibility outside of the home, right? It's like the second shift. And so what I try to encourage women to do is to really ask for help. Employ their partners. If their kids are old enough, get them involved. If they absolutely have to make second meals, make them really, really simple so that they can, you know, focus on their own well-being if they're in the middle of a big dietary shift that nobody is on board for. You know, make meals that are easy and make lots of them, batch cook them, freeze them so that your family can become more self-reliant. And the truth is, healing is all about self-reliance. That is a theme that you and I have been talking about through this entire interview. It's not about outsourcing. It's about calling on our own reserves and our own resilience. So I think we've got to be kinder to ourselves. We got to get off our own backs, and we need to ask for some help and maybe even delegate some tasks so that we can stick to the program.
Asking for help isn't easy for all of us.
True. True, John.
but it's, I suspect that the harder it is for us, you know, the more we're disinclined to do it, the more important it is that we do so.
I think that's beautiful. Maybe that is the spiritual assignment if you have trouble with it.
You know, Chris, what are the things these days that are making you glad you're alive?
Oh my goodness. Well, talking to you, I like to be in the moment. So right now,
thank you.
Feels really good. And, you know, spring is here. I'm very excited about my garden. I started gardening a few years ago, and I love, you know, learning more and growing more. I have a beautiful family. I have an incredible dog. I just lost one of my dogs, but he taught me so much about living and resilience and the power of love. So reflecting on his time with me has been a very positive experience for me in this past season. And I'm excited about everything that is to come. More living and loving, I think, John. That's what I hope for, at least.
I'm sure it will come. You know, you just said you lost a dog that taught you so much. Well, the animals in our lives that become part of our lives, part of our hearts in profound ways, often teach us things that are profoundly important. could you tell us about this dog, who he was to you, and what you learned from this dog?
That's a wonderful question that I very much appreciate. So I love animals, and I live in Woodstock, New York, and I've always wanted many rescues. And I'm also very busy, so my husband has been like, let's wait until you settle down a little bit before we increase the brood here. But when I moved here, I was also very much making peace with the fact that we couldn't have children. So one of the things that cancer has, one of the downsides to living with the disease that I have is that I really had to make the choice between that, between my health and potentially having a child. And so we chose not to. And around that time, I decided I really wanted at least a second dog. If I couldn't have the other critters, I wanted a second dog. And I prayed for this dog. I was like, honey, can we get this dog now? I know I travel, but is it time? Can we do it now? And eventually, you know, he relented. I can put on a very good marketing campaign when I need to. And so the day he said, like, yes, let's get another dog, we celebrated by going up this mountain that we love on a beautiful hike. And I was talking about how excited I was and how great life was going to be with this second dog. And underneath it, I was kind of healing my broken heart for not having children. And we came around this corner and we see the most emaciated, sick, I thought at death's door dog, who was basically in a pile on the side of this trail. And through the kindness of many strangers, we got him down this mountain. And I knew he was our son. He was our boy. We already had a little girl. He was our boy. And for about 6 months, we nursed him back to health. And he just blossomed. He taught me the same lessons that I learned in the beginning of my own healing journey, like to give me good nourishment, to give me proper rest. Don't push me too hard. There are moments where he put up boundaries because I was being a little too cuddly, you know, and he was really nursing some very deep physical wounds. And so when he came to life, so to speak, I was just like, this is my miracle. You know, he is my miracle. But not long after that, he was diagnosed with ALS.
Oh.
And I had no idea that dogs could get ALS. And that's when, you know, the journey got even deeper, because we became his caregivers, and he ended up living 2 years longer than the doctors expected. And he was in a wheelchair, and he was just the most profound. He was like the mayor of the porch. He was such an example of, like, he was just an incredible rescue. He taught people about the power of love and resilience, and that even though he was disabled, he was still whole. And he definitely became my whole metaphor for miracles, that sometimes we want life to be a very specific way. And we put it out there like we have to have this, that, and the other thing. And if we don't get this, that, and the other thing, it somehow didn't work out for us. But miracles and love are all around us, like a river that we can dip into. And our job is to notice them. And so I noticed Buddy. And rescuing him was more like rescuing myself.
It sounds as though in rescuing him, he rescued you.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was something. When you said that even though he was disabled, he was whole, that's to me the miracle, to be able to see that in ourselves and in each other, that yes, we have defects, yes, have our repetitive patterns, our obsessions, our addictions, our confusions. We're human, and we're, as you said, the point is progress, not perfection. And I keep hearing from you this same profound sense of embracing with reverence and respect who we are, whatever our level of health, and embracing at the same time our desire to be as healthy as we can be, but not as an opposition, but an inclusion, an integration. We are both dealing with the diseases we are dealing with the problems we are dealing with in our lives, And we are at the same time inspired beings capable of more than we know, more than we've yet learned, more than we've yet seen. And here is an animal, buddy, who came into your life to not to live a long life and not to run around like we normally think of as an optimal dog life. But what a beautiful and precious story and experience that you had with him.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for that. I mean, I think you really described it. It is that dance that we do, that dance between accepting who we are and pushing ourselves to go beyond. And that is what's fun. That is the sweet spot. And certainly Buddy taught me that in spades. And, you know, we're talking about the power of this diet and lifestyle. And I have to say that compassion is the beating heart of it. And so many of us are animal lovers. You know, we have dogs and cats. And when I blogged about Buddy's passing, I probably got about 3,000 comments on social media and at my blog. And everybody could relate because we've all, so many of us have lost our best friends, our animal companions. And the grief is deep. It's just as real. And people don't talk about it like they talk about losing, you know, a mother, a father, or a partner. But I think it's a really good time to pivot and say that our job as compassionate beings is to extend our heart to more creatures. So my beautiful Buddy is no different than the pig, the cow, the lamb, the chicken. They all want to be loved. They all want to socialize. They want to share their love. They want to play. They want to convalesce when they're not feeling well. And they would love respect. And so as we improve our diets and our lifestyles for our own well-being, and we shift away from certainly the factory farm system and making animals the center of our plate multiple times a day, which does not serve our health, it depreciates our health. Then is when I believe we really step into our true spiritual nature as compassionate beings and light forces, because our life is our legacy. That's what our legacy is. Not some great award that you get. It's how we live our life that matters. And what we put on our plate also is a big part of how we live our life.
Chris, it's such a joy to hear you speak so much truth in such a loving way. I see why there are millions of people who look to you for guidance. I so appreciate the bright and life-giving spirit that shines through you. Your journey invites each of us, whatever we're facing, to live every day of our lives to the fullest and to love those we love with our whole hearts. On behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the food revolution, I want to thank you, Chris, for your outstanding work, for your beautiful example, for your heartfelt message to us all, and of course, for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
We've been talking with Chris Carr, director of Crazy Sexy Cancer and author of many bestsellers, including Crazy Sexy Kitchen. Chris, food can be a serious topic because the stakes can be so high. What we eat can literally determine whether we live in health or die in pain. But you bring so much levity to this conversation. You make healthy living irresistible. We want to thank you for your time, for your wisdom, for your powerful work, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you, Ocean.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.